I'd like to dedicate this shiur in memory of my great grandfather of Avram Yitzchak ben Reb Shmuel Tzvi Kopfer, and in memory of Devorah Steuben. In shiur 18, we will discuss in a general way how meat is prepared. Now, I debated if it pays to discuss this chapter at all, since much of it is practical, and that is not our purpose. However, it occurred to me that what was once fairly obvious to any Jewish mother is just about unknown to your average Jewish person today, including myself, since we do not need to prepare meat because this is usually done by a koshering agency, either on a more industrial level or by a local vad. Therefore, at least in a general way, I would like to look at how meat is prepared in order to have some basic knowledge of this topic. A properly slaughtered kosher animal may not be eaten until a number of items are removed from the animal, and these include blood, chelev, the gid hanasha, and other parts that we are not allowed to consume. The first part of this process is called niker, and this refers to removing fats, arteries, and veins that are usser. And the second part is called melicha, which is the way that we remove blood from the meat. The individual who removes these forbidden fats is called the menaker, and the process is nikur, which in English is translated as purging. The act of nikur must be learned from a skilled individual who is a Yorei Shamayim. It cannot be learned from books and the like. However, it is essential to have some idea of how nikur is done and the repercussions of not performing it correctly. An informed Jewish public, as they say, is the best guarantor for kashrus. Now, since women are commonly the ones who prepare meat, it's essential that they are educated and well-versed in this area. Basically, there are portions of the animal removed throughout the entire animal. So parts of the head, near the jawbone, near the ears, part of the tongue and mouth, parts of the throat, chest, arteries, and portions of the ribs, and other areas that have arteries. Now, as we pointed out earlier, in many communities, the entire hindquarters is sold off and not consumed at all. And I believe that's what we do in America. There are some places that allow the heart to be eaten if it's prepared correctly, and other places where the custom is not to eat it at all. The stomachs each need preparation, some of which involve Torah prohibitions if not performed properly. Just read some of it inside now. He says, in view of the biblical injunction affecting the conscience of the porger, one could well imagine the meticulous and anxious care expected of him who is engaged in the process of porging, especially of the parts mentioned just above. One can also fully appreciate how the custom arose in many communities not to eat hindquarter meat at all because of the quantity of forbidden fat it contains, especially around the loins and kidneys, and because of the difficulty of removing it properly. Now, the intestines also need to be treated carefully, as well as the hooves of cattle, which need to be cut in a specific manner before the koshering process can begin. Moving on to Gid Hanasha, we know that Yaakov had a fight with some sort of being at night, and it injured Yaakov on his thigh. This is a description of our struggle throughout our history with the violence which temporarily harms us, but which cannot actually conquer us. Our Chachamim have interpreted this dietary law in many different ways, some of which include a representation of Jewish history, as well as the struggle that man has with his evil inclination. In terms of Gid Hanasha, the commandment applies to both behemos and chayos, but not to birds. However, there are certain birds where there is a rabbinic decree not to partake of certain sinews in the thigh. In terms of birds, Dan Grunfeld gets into serious detail of how a bird is examined and which portions must be removed. He points out that in the past, this was typically something that every housewife knew how to do and passed this information down to their daughters. Once again, today this is just about forgotten, but he points out that people should still be familiar with these laws for two reasons. One, it is possible to find oneself in a situation where you will need to check the bird yourself. And second, it is important to be familiar with these laws so one knows when to ask the Rav a she'ila, a question. Today, however, if one has a question regarding a bird, I do have my doubts if your local shul rabbi will be able to help you. One would probably need to bring the bird to a local posek to take a look at it. So please see the book for all the details of what you should do, what should be checked, what should be removed, and what the process is and how it's done. Now, in terms of today, we get birds that are already gutted. Usually do not find the bird's entrails inside of it. So for us, if you find a broken bone or a bruised bone or discoloration, any sort of growths or sharp items in the flesh, that might be the time where you want to bring it to a posek to ask the posek if everything is okay. Today, since everything is done on a mass scale and there are mashgichim who check the birds before they are packaged, there probably will never be a problem, but if an issue arises and one has any doubt, then definitely the right thing to do is to check with a rav. The liver, if one has fresh liver, it needs to be a specific color, and if it's not, a rav should be consulted. Even making liver has its own kosherous process, which we will look at later on. Now, if one bought a whole bird, say an entire chicken or a turkey, they need to ask the rav a question. It's important to bring the entire bird to the Rav, not just the part which is suspect. Of course, everything that we have said is very brief, and we're just mentioning some of the basics to give some idea of what the Nikur process is by a bird, and when one possibly should go ask a Rav a question. Let's move on to the next part, which is how to perform Melicha, which is the salting process to remove blood, sometimes called Kasherin. Again, the author states that it is characteristic that this task devolves upon the Jewish housewife and mother. In her hands are both the kashrus of the home and the early education of the children. Both tasks belong together and make a considerable contribution to the sanctity of the home and the character training of the children. Remember, the Torah tells us that the observance of kashrus, specifically the consummation of blood, directly affects every Jewish child. When the Torah tells us in Devarim in 12:25, it says, "You shall not eat it, the blood, so that it may go well with your children after you, when you shall do what is right in the eyes of Hashem." Now, Dan Grunfeld has an interesting anecdote in the footnote. He says that during the time that the Sefer was being written, it was becoming more and more common for meat to come kashered, like we are familiar with, or fully salted, and then prepared when you purchase it. And he describes the fact that these basic halachos are not known anymore, which led to the following situation. He says, some years ago, a Jewish girl from an Orthodox home married a Jewish Orthodox boy from another town. In the hometown of the girl, the meat, both of cattle and fowl, had been delivered, made kosher, to her parental home, as was the general usage in her hometown. She therefore never saw her mother kashering meat or a fowl, and knew nothing of that practice. In her new home, where the meat was not kashered by the butcher, she started cooking it immediately after delivery by the butcher, and it was only by a visit of her mother-in-law that it was found out that she had made her whole household treif. So that is truly a terrible story. Although I think today the metzias has really changed. I don't think you could purchase meat without a hechsher from your local butcher. I mean, I personally have never heard of such a thing. Of course, you could purchase your own animal. You can get it shechted. And in that case, somebody would need to perform all the halachos that we've been discussing. There are two parts to preparing meat for melicha. First, the meat is soaked. There are two reasons for this. It washes off any congealed blood, and it opens the meat up so that the salting process will be more effective to pull out the blood. Being that this is the case, It is important for the water to be room temperature, since cold water would not be as effective in allowing the salt to work. So the meat, bones, fat, all of this is taken, it's placed in a special type of vessel, and allowed to soak for a half an hour. Any large portions of congealed fat can be rubbed off, and bruised meat is also cut out. The meat should also be turned to make sure that water touches every part of it. When the meat is removed, the water needs to drain off before the salt is sprinkled on. If before salting the meat is cut, or if the salt has not already been on the meat for a half an hour, it may need to be soaked again. If the meat is frozen, it needs to thaw, and clearly one cannot use hot water or fire to thaw it out. That would cause major troubles. If the bloody meat was left soaking in water for 24 hours, it is considered cooked. That the term we use is kavush. And in such a case, a rav should be consulted as to how to properly prepare the meat. It's not allowed to be cooked or fried, but one should be allowed to grill it. And also, what to do with the pot that the meat was soaking in. Meat that was not koshered for 3 full days, for 3 24-hour periods, needs to be koshered in a special way, since salting and soaking will not be effective. Again, there is a method of making this meat permissible by roasting it on a spit, and one should ask a rav exactly how this is done. Now, this whole procedure is bidyeved. You are not allowed initially to leave meat unsoaked in order to roast it. In other words, we allow you to do this if it happened by mistake. The truth is, since many people will not have the proper equipment to roast the meat in the required manner, as a rule, it will generally be usher to consume this meat. Now, a way around this issue is to water down the meat within the first 3 days. If water is placed on the meat, then the 72-hour time period starts over. So, for example, if after 2 days the meat is watered down, you now have 3 more days to perform the regular method of kashering. Now, some people will not use this heter, and any meat that is more than 3 days old, regardless of if it was watered down or not, will not be used by them. I just want to point out again that we are leaving out many details, so if for some reason such a situation should come up, we definitely speak to a competent rav. This scenario of having meat unattended for 3 days actually comes up on a more mass scale when slaughtered meat is transferred by truck from one location to another. So while this might not be applicable in one's standard household today, kosher organizations often need to deal with this. There is also a controversy surrounding frozen meat and what status this has vis-a-vis this process of needing to be watered or not, or if it slows down that process, and how that works exactly. So let's move on now to the salting process. The meat at this point was soaking for half an hour, and it is salted for 1 hour. Now, there are extenuating circumstances in which one may reduce this time to 15 minutes for soaking and a half hour for salting, such as late in the day on Erev Shabbos, along with other situations. And in these cases, the meat actually needs to be rinsed and washed several times, both before and after salting, until the water that runs through it loses any sort of reddish tinge. Now, coming back to our typical case, the meat was just soaked for your requisite half hour. It's then placed on a salting board, which has perforations or grooves in it, and there are some that are made out of some type of wicker material. And this board is placed on an angle so that everything drains off of it. Before adding salt, the meat should be drained from any excess water that was left on it. Now, the type of salt that is used is what we know as kosher salt, and it's only called kosher salt because it's used in the koshering process. That term has nothing to do with the salt itself. The reason that this salt is used is because the grains can't be too coarse, since if they are, it will fall off. And also the grains shouldn't be too fine, since the salt will dissolve before the koshering process could actually finish. It's important to salt meat fairly soon after it finishes soaking, since if the meat is dry, the salt will be unable to stick to it, and it won't draw the blood out the way it's supposed to. So you take the salt, It's sprinkled over the entire piece of meat and into any folds, and in birds, the inside is salted as well. And even though the entire piece of meat must be covered in salt, a very thick layer of salt would block the blood from draining. So therefore, we don't put a thick layer on, but we do make sure that it's covered. The actual pieces of meat are arranged carefully on the board so that they do not touch or somehow block each other from draining properly. Meat with less blood is placed higher up on the board, such as, for example, bones, fat, and white meat, while red meat, such as beef, is placed lower on the board. Now, the next section discusses individual organs and how to properly salt them, and these include the head, brain, hoofs, bones, the heart, which is often not eaten anyway. I'm not even sure if some of these other parts are eaten as well, and the lungs. So we're going to skip the details on all of this. Let's move on to the liver, which has more practicality to it. Now, from a biological point of view, the liver itself is involved with blood clotting, breaking down old and damaged blood cells. In other words, it cleans your blood, and it produces bile for digestion and stores glycogen, which is a type of sugar. Now, for our purposes, we need to know that the liver is saturated with blood due to its various jobs involved with blood cleaning. Now, the liver may not be kosher in the regular koshering manner due to this large amount of blood in it and the fact that it has a smooth surface and it's a very compact piece of meat which will not allow salt to effectively work on it. Certain portions of the liver are removed and then it's either cut or pierced several times. It's then rinsed and then roasted or grilled on an open fire. And as it roasts, the person doing it sprinkles salt on it, and again, it needs to be pierced. And all of these actions help the blood to drain out of the liver. Now, the liver is done when it turns a grayish white color. We don't actually need to char it or burn it because that would be destroying it, and you don't need to do that. Once it turns this color, then it's considered done. And after the process is over, the liver is then rinsed 3 times in water. And once this is done, then you could do what you want. You could pan roast the liver or however you prepare it. Now, if one made a mistake and cooked an unkosher liver, it can't be eaten. And the vessel used to cook the food is treif. And of course, one will need to consult a rav. If the liver was soaked in water for 24 hours, then it is kavush. It's considered cooked, and thereby it is aser. And one will need to consult a rav since there might be certain mitigating factors to take into consideration. If meat and liver are soaked together for 24 hours, both the meat and the vessel are aser. Again, consult a rav. If the liver was soaked in salty or spicy water, then the kavush process speeds up, and in the time it would take to heat up the water on an actual fire, the liver becomes aser. If the liver fell into water or some vinegar mixture, then all you need to do is rinse it off and then kosher it as you would regularly do. There are other situations that can come up, so again, one should always consult with a rav who's an expert on these matters. If one salted a bird and then you find that the liver is still in the bird, so you have to cut away the liver and a thin layer of meat goes with it. If it was cooked, the piece of the liver that was attached is aser. And the rest will need to be examined by a rav to determine if it is batel, nullified, by the other content in the pot, which will be difficult since, in this case, because the liver is attached to the bird, you would need 60 times the entire fowl. Now, if the liver was not attached to the bird, then you need 60 times the liver to the actual everything else in the pot. So the meat would count in this case against the liver. So as you could see, making these calculations is difficult. And a rav will need to be consulted. Other items discussed in terms of kashering include the spleen, which is called the milt, intestines, and the stomach or stomachs. Any eggs found inside a fowl, regardless of if they are fully formed or not, are treated exactly like meat and need to be salted, except that we salt them away from other portions of meat, and one is not allowed to have them with milk, of course. More generally, one needs to be careful that salted pieces of meat do not fall back into the drained liquid or that the liquid falls into any utensils or food. If the meat falls onto the counter or some other location where it cannot drain, then you need to cut off the part which came into contact with the counter or pot or whatever it was touching. Again, seek out a rav. If non-kosher meat was accidentally cooked, it is usur, of course. If it's cooked with other food, it's going to need 60 times the amount of meat to permit the rest of the food, or else the entire contents are usur. And the meat, of course, is usur. If the meat is koshered and a piece falls in that is not koshered, so if you can't find the non-koshered piece of meat, then assuming that there is shishim to the piece that fell in, then everything is permissible. So again, consult a rav. Now, there are many details that we are leaving out, and Dayan Grunfeld ends this particular section by saying that all the above halachic details are mentioned here not in order to enable the housewife to decide on her own the halachic problems of kashrus that may arise in her household, but to give her a lead and general guidance, and especially to enable her to know what constitutes such a problem and when and how to ask a qualified rabbi about it. And of course, his words follow here as well. Again, being that much of this is no longer done in one's home anyway, if a question does come up, it may be all the more difficult to find a rav who is an expert who can answer these questions. Let's move on now to the next part in the koshering process, which is the final rinsing. So the meat has now been salted for 1 hour. The salt is shaken off. It is rinsed due to the blood and salt mixture that is still on it, and it's then washed 2 or 3 times. Now, there are 2 ways to do this. One way to accomplish this is that you place the meat in a vat of water, and then you rinse it 2 times. Another way to accomplish this is that you take the meat and you place it into 3 pots of water. So you take it and put in 1 pot of fresh water, another pot of fresh water, and a 3rd pot of fresh water. It is important that the water should be put in the pot before the meat, and similarly, that the meat should not be put down on a non-perforated location before the final rinsing is done. And if one forgot to do the final rinsing, then there is room to be lenient if the contents of the pot are equal to the meat, since in this case we're not worried about the meat, but rather just the bloody salt. So again, you have to ask a rav all these questions. If one waited too long and the salt is dry, then you would speak to a rav. Now, finally, it's important to have a specific location for non-kosher meat, which avoids all sorts of problems. Now, it's interesting to me that I never knew that, and I would assume if you went into a standard Jewish home 50 to 60 years ago, this is probably common practice in just about every Jewish home, that you'd have a specific location where you kept non-kosher meat. The chapter concludes with a discussion of eggs and blood spots. So in actuality, much of what he discusses doesn't usually apply anymore, since our eggs are not in danger of being fertilized. However, if one purchases fertilized eggs as some sort of a health thing, then all the halachos regarding eggs and blood spots apply. Now, nevertheless, even with our non-fertilized eggs, we are still makbid to check each egg for blood spots in a glass dish, even though they're not fertilized, and if you find an egg with a blood spot, our custom is that we throw it in the garbage. And similarly, we are careful to always boil at least 3 eggs at once. So I refer you again either to this book or any other kashrus book to get the full range of halachos relating to eggs. So in conclusion, I hope this was worth going through in order to get some idea of the basic kashering process, what goes into the meat before we even get it in our homes. And even today, there may be certain situations, as we discussed, where one would go to a rav and ask regarding some of the matters that we mentioned. So this ends our discussion regarding the preparation of meat. And next time, we'll take a look at the laws of basar b'chalav, meat and milk.